Good morning, Mr. Fogel.
Good morning, Judge Rovner. If it pleases the court, Ms. Bacon and Mr. Madden, my name is Don Vogel and I represent the defendant, Offenburg Ford. During the negotiation for a replacement contract in the spring of 2006, Scott Alexander, the business representative from Teamsters Local 50, agreed with the negotiating team from Offenburg Ford that all contributions to the Central States Pension Fund would cease at the expiration of the collective bargaining agreement on April 30th of 2006. He also agreed on the April 30, 2006 implementation of this agreed-upon term, even though the collective bargaining agreement had not yet been completed. Now, Central States disagrees with these points. The district court should have tried these questions of fact, and as such, it was inappropriate for the court to have granted summary judgment. We are asking this court to reverse this case with instructions that the district court try this issue, as resolution of it is critical to all the findings of the court. The business representative, Scott Alexander, and the negotiating team for Offenburg Ford reached an agreement in 2006 that Offenburg Ford could cease contributing to the Central States Pension Fund. This issue was critical to the negotiation that was ongoing at that time, because without that agreement, Offenburg would have been subjected to substantial amounts of withdrawal liability. Now, granted, our motion in the district court also mentioned the basis for that agreement, which was made in 2001 when Offenburg first negotiated the terms of the original collective bargaining agreement. But despite that agreement, which the district court held was unenforceable because of the parole evidence rule, our focus has always been on the 2006 agreement, because without Scott Alexander, the business representative, agreeing to the cessation of our obligation to contribute, we wouldn't be standing here. We would not have had an agreement that we would have been able to stop those contributions.
You know, I'd like to ask you sort of a bottom-line question. Even if we could consider the May and November letters as a separate agreement, only the November letter was signed by both parties.
Correct.
What support do you have for the proposition that the November 2006 letter should relate back to April 30th of 2006 and impact Alfenberg's obligations back to that date, as opposed to altering the terms of the contract that beginning in November?
I have no authority. I mean, I'll be, bottom line, I believe the May 1st letter that was sent by counsel to Central States is sufficient to cease that obligation. At a minimum, when I have that November agreement, which reaches the hands of Central States on December 11th of 2006, that agreement having been signed by both Offenburg and the union, that is when the obligation to contribute should have ceased.
But it's retrospective. That's the point.
Yeah.
The only letter that's signed by both parties that is not unilateral, in other words, comes after the expiration of the agreement and the evergreen provision has kicked in already.
Well, actually, it hasn't kicked in my view. Let me back it up. As first off, again, you know my position is the May 1 letter terminates it effectively.
Well, the problem with that is that it's unilateral, and it's also put, you know, it's after the fact.
I understand. Our position and how this case differs from the Indy Transport case relied upon by the fund is that when Mr. Alexander sends the notice of termination, that evergreen clause doesn't kick in. Now, that's not to say that the terms and conditions of the collective bargaining agreement don't stay in effect until something different is negotiated, but the contract did not automatically renew. If the evergreen clause, as in Indy Transport, would have caused the collective bargaining agreement to renew for another year, then it would have taken another whole collective bargaining agreement to obviate that term about the obligation to contribute. But because the contract was properly terminated, as soon as the parties agree on a term which changes the old collective bargaining agreement, that term is reduced to writing, and that term, more importantly, is communicated to the fund, then that's what ceases the obligation to contribute.
That violates the piecemeal rule.
Well, the piecemeal rule, though, Judge, is when parties, a party to a collective negotiation, wants to impose and implement its own proposal before there is an agreement with the parties. The Central States versus Banky case says that the parties can implement piecemeal terms. There are other cases cited in my brief that say the same thing. If the parties agree, if the parties collectively agree on a term, which they did in Banky, which they did here, and that term is then given to Central States so they have notice of it, so they can see it, then that term can be implemented. It wasn't a piecemeal implementation of a proposal. It was a piecemeal implementation of agreed-upon term, and the cases say that that's appropriate.
In the statement of facts of the response to plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, Alfenberg consistently describes the May and November letters as providing notice of the fund of the prior 2001 agreement and repeatedly characterizes those letters as an attempt to inform the fund of that prior agreement. How then could we expect the district court to address the contention that the May and November letters reflected a separate meeting of the minds reached in 2006? I mean, it seems to me that that argument is waived.
Well, first off, Judge, two things there. When Scott Alexander, the current business representative, signs that November letter, he is indicating his present intent as to what the parties agree. Okay? And as far as the waiver issue, I'm not sure which waiver. If the waiver raised by Central States, again, because you have that letter agreement which states the present intent of Local 50, how can it be waived? It's teed up and it's before the court to consider that Local 50 is agreeing that the obligation to contribute shall cease as of April 30th.
Well, the fund didn't consider that letter sufficient to terminate Alfenberg's obligation.
Of course not, Judge.
And Alfenberg, you know, continued to refuse to waive its prior agreement with Local 50 that it would exit from the fund, you know, as of April 30th, 2006.
Well, Judge, you have two situations there, though. In the first instance, what you have is the fund, rare that they will ever waive anything that would cut off their right to receive contributions. And in this case, they certainly did.
But you see, all that language relates the May and November letters back to the original oral agreement in 2001, you know, and represents that the letters were written to apprise the fund of the prior agreement. And there's nothing that I could find in that statement of facts that would alert a district court, this district court, that Alfenberg considered the May and November letters to reflect a separate agreement that had been reached in 2006.
Judge, I think it's our statement of fact number 33 where it says in here, and it lays out the agreement from 2001, and at the end of it it says, Alexander agreed. And that is exactly what this November 13th letter said.
I know, but that's you saying Alexander agreed. I mean, look, let me put it this way. Let's say some person sends a letter saying that he owns my home, okay? I never respond. He then sends 10 more letters. Does he own my home?
No, Your Honor.
Well,
but in this instance, what we did is there was agreements in place, the participation agreement, the trust agreement, the collective bargaining agreement, that dictated how we are to notify Central States. And Judge Easterbrook, in his decision in Gerber Truck, said, hey, you can't let a pension fund sit unaware of what's going on. You can't let them be bound by secret side agreements that they don't know about. In this case, Central States knew about it. We gave them notice. We gave them notice on May 1, 2006. And I understand the court doesn't like that document because it wasn't signed by both of the parties, but the November agreement was. It was a written agreement. That's all that's required by Banky, all that's required by the trust agreement, a written agreement saying, as far as this overall collective bargaining agreement is concerned, we have decided that one portion of it will end, and that's the obligation to contribute. And this letter refers to the negotiations in 2006. Judge Gettleman had this in front of him. Yeah, sure, Judge, I would love to rewrite my response to the summary judgment. 2020 of hindsight's like that. But this issue was in there, that the court didn't buy it, that Central States argued only about the 2001, doesn't mean I've waived it, Judge. It was clear from Mr. Alexander signing this agreement in November 2006 that he agreed at the present time that the obligation to contribute will end. And that notice was communicated to Central States. That's what Gerber requires. That's what the participation agreement requires. That's what the trust agreement requires. We gave that notice.
Well, the participation and trust agreements require the submission of the entire agreement, that is to say the new collective bargaining agreement into which this term is incorporated, as I read those documents.
And as I read them, and I think that if you look just at the words of those documents, that's not what they require. They don't say...
Shall promptly submit the entire agreement or modification to the funds contracts department.
Well, but Judge, that's not the provision that embodies this. And we did submit the entire agreement. The entire agreement as it relates to terminating the obligation to contribute. It doesn't say a complete new collective bargaining agreement. It just says submit the new agreement. So we submitted that new portion of the agreement which terminated the obligation to contribute. I would like to reserve the rest of my time to respond.
Bacon. Come on up.
May it please the court, my name is Laura Bacon, and I represent the appellees, Central States Pension Fund, and one of its trustees. Offenberg's entire appeal is predicated on the existence of an oral agreement purportedly reached between Offenberg and Local 50 at some point in 2006.
Short of putting the 2001 agreement in writing initially, what could Offenberg have done as the April 30th, 2006 date approach to ensure that it, could discontinue its obligation as of that date? I should say obligations.
Offenberg would have had to reach a new collective bargaining agreement with Local 50 and submit that written agreement to the pension fund by April 30th, 2006.
So, in other words, if they'd obtained an agreement such as the November letter earlier and submitted it 60 days before the April date, that would have made the difference.
Well, I would submit that the November 2006 letter was not actually a written agreement because it specifically says that it's merely evidence of an agreement that was reached prior to April 30th, 2006. And further, no, I don't believe that that letter would have, or an agreement just on the pension contributions, would have satisfied terminating Offenberg's contribution obligation because of the specific language that was in the 2001 collective bargaining agreement, which continued all the terms and conditions.
So would it matter if the letter declared that it was a separate agreement unrelated to the earlier oral agreement?
It would not matter.
It would not matter.
It had to have been an entire collective bargaining agreement in order to terminate the obligation.
So what you're saying is that the one they entered into the following January would have had to have been in place on May 1st.
Correct.
In order for this... for them not to be able to take advantage, I don't know, they can't, they wouldn't be taking advantage of the five-year free look,
Your Honor.
The free look doesn't mean you're not, were they not paying in all that time?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
What, paying in, what, when you're having to pay for into the pension fund, did they pay into the pension fund during that five-year free look?
They paid into the pension fund actually over a course of 6 years and would not have been eligible for the five-year look, free look anyways. But the idea, the concept of the five-year free look is that had they contributed for a period of 5 years and ceased their obligation on time, that they would not have had to pay the withdrawal liability.
And in the January 1st, they, I guess, agreed to continue to pay into the pension fund, right? The new agreement.
In the new agreement, they actually agreed to replace the pension fund with a 401k plan,
okay. So
I believe.
They did change this.
I believe so, yes.
Okay, so if they had done that by May 1st or January or June 30th, whatever, then it would have been locked in. And that, would that have achieved the free look?
Our position is that no, it would not have. Because
is that free look worth anything?
In this case?
Yeah.
The free look was available to Offenburg had they ceased their contribution obligation within the 5 years, according to the rules.
Well, the only way they could do that was by declaring an impasse or something, wouldn't it? If they're going to have these people continue to work and under some kind of a collective bargaining agreement where they continue to negotiate.
I don't know what that, short of reaching impasse or entering into a new collective bargaining agreement, they could not cease their contribution obligation. And again, it's our position that because of the term of this, because their contribution obligation continued even to April 30th, 2006, that the five-year free look was not available to Offenburg.
Yeah, well, that's what I keep running into. I don't, it looks like a free look means that's all it is a look. It doesn't worth anything.
It would have been. It would have been available to them. Like I said, I hope I'm answering your question.
No, I guess not. That's all right. Go ahead.
I'd like to address the issue that came up earlier about waiver. It is the pension fund's position that Offenburg, in this court, is basing its entire agreement argument on a 2006 oral agreement between the parties, and that was waived because it was never raised before the district court. And there was some discussion of the facts that are in the record regarding the alleged 2006 oral agreement, but I'd like to point out that it's in particular the arguments that Offenburg makes that are based on those facts that need to be considered for the waiver inquiry. It's not enough that the general issue of an agreement between the parties was raised. Offenburg needed to specifically present its argument relying on the 2006 oral agreement in order to preserve this issue for appeal. In fact, the district court made a finding that all of Offenburg's evidence was, in fact, reliant on the alleged oral agreement that was reached in 2001 between the parties. I would also like to address the fact that even if the parties had reached this agreement in 2006, it was indisputably an oral agreement, and oral agreements are simply not binding on the pension fund. The pension fund is entitled to rely on the writings that it receives, and in this case was entitled to rely on the language of the collective bargaining agreement that it received in 2001. It's also entitled to rely on the terms of the participation agreement and the trust agreement. And in fact, this requirement that these agreements relating to pension contributions be in writing is precisely it's precisely created to address this type of a situation where the pension fund has been put in the middle of a dispute between the employer and the local union. In this case, Offenburg suggesting that this court remand the case for a trial. Considering the issue of mainly conversations that occurred between the employer and the local union to which the pension fund was not a party. The pension fund needs to be able to rely on the written agreement so that it can award pension credit accordingly. And we awarded this credit despite the fact that Offenburg stopped making contributions to the pension fund as of April 30th, 2006. And again, I'd like to reiterate that the letters that were sent to the pension fund, both dated May 1st, 2006 and November 13th, 2006, which actually didn't arrive until mid-December, those writings were merely evidence of an agreement that was purportedly reached by a party, by the parties prior to April 30th, 2006. those letters are very carefully worded. Although they are written communication, they're not agreements. They're not, they don't attach agreements. It doesn't say this is an agreement that is reached by the parties. There's no evidence that there was present intent, as Mr. Vogel said, by the union to make this agreement. In fact, at the time we were receiving these letters, and this evidence is in the record, the local union, both Mr. Alexander and one of the bargaining unit members, was contacting the pension fund and telling us that, in fact, there was no agreement. The parties were still in negotiations for a new collective bargaining agreement.
As I understand the chronology, the company's obligation to contribute to the fund expired with the predecessor contract to the 2001 to 2006 contract, correct?
That the obligation expired?
That the obligation to contribute expired. They paid withdrawal liability and were out, and then there was a negotiation for the company to reenter the fund, which is the background circumstances of this alleged oral agreement in 2001.
Correct.
That they would do so contingent upon this five-year free look being available, and that's the alleged oral agreement. That's the subject of the alleged oral agreement, that the five-year
in
free look would be available. Right, in 2001,
correct.
That it would be available, which is to say that their obligation then would cease at the expiration of the contract without any withdrawal liability.
That was the agreement
with Mr. Green that was never memorialized in writing and never found its way into the 2001 collective bargaining agreement.
That's correct.
Is that the sort of thing that would have been memorialized in the collective bargaining agreement? This five-year free look, is that typically the subject of negotiations such that it would be memorialized in a CBA?
The five-year free look specifically, I don't know, you know, that might have been memorialized, and of course it's up to the parties, you know, drafting the contract.
It's statutory.
It is. It's statutory, and of course depends on the duration of time that the employer was making contributions. So certainly it could have been memorialized in the contract that the obligation to contribute would have ceased on a date certain.
Right, and that would have made this very clear, and we wouldn't have this confusion.
Correct.
And the letters in 2006, the sort of post hoc letters, all refer to this prior agreement.
That's correct. The purported 2001 agreement, oral agreement, yes.
Right. I mean, that's the way that the district court viewed this chronology.
That's correct.
Is that the 2006 letters were not evidence of a new agreement, but were meant to retrospectively memorialize the 2001 agreement, as I understand.
That's correct. And even in Offenberg's statement of facts and in the summary judgment briefing, they use, you know, this term prior agreement, which is seemingly ambiguous, but if you read all of the facts in order, it's clear that the term prior agreement is referring to this purported 2001 oral agreement. And in fact, the way they state it is that Offenberg was reiterating that it was not willing to waive this prior agreement that it claims that it made with the union in 2001. And finally, I'd just like to reiterate the point I think we touched on, that when the parties did enter into the new collective bargaining agreement in January of 2007, they're unable to make a retroactive determination that the contribution obligation could have ceased on April 30th of 2006. They're unable to take that credit away from the fund participants, and they're unable to take that away, that asset of the fund. There's no further questions. Thank you.
Three and a half.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could quote from the November 13th letter, it says, "This letter will confirm that before April 30, 2006, Teamsters Local 50 and Offenberg had reached an understanding that Offenberg's participation in the fund would end April 30, 2006 with the expiration of the bargaining agreement between Local 50 and Offenberg. While a written agreement formalizing this understanding had not been finalized, Local 50 and Offenberg had concluded that regardless of any other agreements that may or may not be reached, between Offenberg and Teamsters Local 50, no further duty to participate in Central States after April 30 would exist. They say that this understanding had not been finalized. If they were referring to the 2001 agreement, that agreement was finalized in the collective bargaining agreement negotiated by John Green. The agreement that's being referred to in here is the replacement contract. That's the agreement that we were talking about, was the 2006 agreement. Now, as far as whether or not the terms of that agreement were memorialized, we believe that's what the May 1st, 2006 letter did. We believe that's what this November 13th, 2006 letter did. It confirmed to Central States, it gave them the notice that Gerber Truck requires, that the ERISA statute requires, that the participation agreement and the trust agreement requires they be given. They chose not to heed it. They chose to continue to give service credits to the men, but the bottom line is they had notice. Now, Judge Sykes, you were commenting about how the participation agreement requires a new collective bargaining agreement. Again, I looked at the language as I was sitting there, and it does not require that. It just says that if they agree to change the collective bargaining agreement, that modification, agreement, or understanding must be presented to the fund. That's what happened. We presented that modification. The Behnke case tells us that the parties can agree in writing to a change in a collective bargaining agreement, give that notice to the fund, and the fund then must follow that notice.
So this letter we're supposed to construe as a modification to the Evergreen provision?
It was a modification to the fact that the obligation to contribute would cease. And, again, I believe
But the cessation of the obligation to contribute was not part of the 2001 CBA. So there's nothing to modify there.
Well, what's being modified is the obligation to contribute.
It is a modification of the Evergreen provision.
Well, Judge, where I differ is that the Evergreen provision doesn't apply because the contract was terminated by the letter from Scott Alexander.
Point of the Evergreen provision is to keep its protections in place while a new contract is negotiated.
I understand that. That's what paragraph 5 of the participation agreement requires. It says that while the parties are still negotiating, unless certain other things happen, we require you to continue to make contributions while you are negotiating. The Evergreen clause only kicks in if that contract's not terminated. Labor law does require the parties to maintain the status quo while that contract is being negotiated. But to the extent that the parties modify the terms and notice of that modification is given to the fund, then we had the right to stop contributing. Again, I think it's the May 1st letter that allows us to quit contributing. At a minimum, it's that November 13th letter that the fund receives on December 11th, which requires us. And Judge Mannion, to your point, the five-year free look exists by statute. It's not incorporated in collective bargaining agreements. And our position is if we would cease the obligation as of April 30, 2006, there would be no withdrawal liability, and that matter is being litigated separately from this case.
Well, you mean there would be no further? What if there's no agreement as of May 1st? What would happen with that free look?
The only reason there was an agreement in this case is because, as Judge Sykes noted, Offenberg participated in the fund in earlier years. And the agreement with Central States was simply, is the five-year free look available to us if we go back into the fund in 2001.
You were trying to preserve that for two or three or five people.
We're just trying to preserve to make sure, we for two or three or four more bargaining unit members, that it was still available because Offenberg would not go back into the fund unless they could get out within 5 years and not incur another withdrawal liability. And why was that not included? I don't know. I was not party to it.
You never asked anybody? I understand you weren't party to it, but that's a very logical question. Why wasn't
it? It is a very logical question. I think the logical answer is, honestly, if Central States, the position counsel has always taken with me is, if Central States receives a contract that says, and at the end of this term, we will cease our obligation, they will reject that contract. So I believe it was not put in because it could not be put in because Central States will not allow a prospective agreement which automatically cuts off the rights. They prefer to let people have to negotiate in the next round. And the free look is statutory. And so the onus is on the parties to negotiate the end of its obligation to contribute, which we believe we did. Thank you very much.
To all counsel, the case will be taken under advisement.